CBS News this week had a finding that was pretty alarming. Teens are turning to TikTok for mental health advice, and they are self-diagnosing themselves with what they think is wrong. In fact, according to a recent Pew Research survey, one in six Gen Zers, so the generation below mine, use TikTok as a search engine. It's not just a place to watch those dance videos and lip-syncing videos, but it's also to find bite-sized chunks of informational content, to the point that kids are self-diagnosing themselves. I don't know about you, Krista Carnes, our social media consultant here this morning, but back in my day, people were always self-diagnosing themselves, but with WebMD. Did you ever do that? Did you ever go down the rabbit hole of WebMD?
Oh, yeah, and I might actually be honest and tell you that occasionally I just Google what symptoms I currently have and see what I can figure out.
Come on, Krista, you of anyone, I'm a little disappointed. I have this argument all the time with my sister-in-law. She is a classic WebMD woman. I mean, she will literally call me and she'll say, like, I don't feel good today. You know, we can't have a play date with the kids today. And I'm like, all right, that's fine. And then a minute later, she'll text me and she'll be like, do you think this is? And I'm like, don't you dare tell me you look this up. And she's like, well, I'm just thinking. And I'm like, don't you dare. Oh my Lord, with the looking it up. I don't know. I mean, maybe if it's like, hey, why is my skin turning green if I just touch this plant outside? I can understand that because it's so specific, but I just never,
general,
oh my gosh, no,
yeah,
I do it, no.
And here's the thing, like, I mean, I think there's looking for information and actual research. And when you showed me that, you shared that CBS clip, the young woman that's featured in it, she called it research. That's what
right.
She thought research was, right? So that's sort of a problem. But I also wonder if you're vulnerable because you have anxiety or depression, which she had said she was diagnosed with, that's what's going to, you're going to find what you're looking for, right? Like, you're going to find something that's going to confirm what you think you already know or heighten, you know, you're never going to walk away and be like, I'm fine, right? Like, I mean, we're probably very
rarely.
Right.
I mean, I think that's one of the good things about social media is the fact that it has opened these doors to conversations I know we didn't have in the 90s. You never talked about if you were depressed. You never talked about things like if you have anxiety or you feel like you're lonely or you're down or things are off. I mean, so social media has made it very easy and comfortable to find groups where you can connect with other teens who might be struggling or groups for moms or parents who are working
right.
or whatever. So there is some good to this, but I think the idea of if you are not doing, like you said, I think there's a huge difference between research and coming across something and then just deciding, well, oh, this must be me. Sounds like me. It's got to be me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I also think that, I don't know if you, I'm sure you caught wind of it, like the CDC released a report in like towards the end of February talking about teen mental health and particularly teen girls like really struggling. And, you know, a lot of the subsequent articles that have come out have focused on, you know, sort of the emotional and mental health of these kids because of social media, you know, impacts or, mm-hmm. you know, that it makes, which you and I, we've talked about that many times on the show. And you know, I think where we get into dangerous territory is when you, when the algorithms are there to feed you more content about whatever you're looking for, which to me
yes.
seems dangerous because there's no clear-cut way to determine whether that information is true, right? Sharing
yes.
your story, and yeah. There was that one San Diego professor who was featured in that clip, and she was talking about, you know, if I'm up there saying this is my struggle with this eating disorder or this mental health challenge, and I'm really glad that I went and got help. And, you know, I mean, like there's ways of telling your story that can be very supportive and connect with others in a helpful way. When you are saying, oh, well, if you do this, and this, you've got to have ADHD or you've got to have, mm-hmm. you know, you definitely have this problem. You're not qualified to do that. And you're also telling the algorithms in all the platforms that's the kind of content that you're responding to and that you're spending time with. So it's going to send you more of the same. So
I've noticed that.
I don't, mm-hmm. right. And I don't know. I mean, if it's, and you know, young woman in the story, she ended up going to like a rehab for social media, like get off her phone for 35 or whatever many days.
Yeah. I mean, look, Krista, I like, and you, and Krista Carnes is our social media consultant. If you're just tuning in, I've talked about this with you and my audience extensively. I don't really use social media except for Instagram. And my only true purpose for Instagram, honest to God, is to stay basically connected with the Disney community. I like to know which rides are coming in. I like to know what changes are coming to the park. I like to keep up on merchandise. Like I like to do that. And I like to support small businesses that do Disney-esque kind of merchandise, like ears and things like that. But I don't really use social media for anything beyond it. But I will say, if I'm going through reels, very similar to TikTok videos, and I like random people's reels, like they don't have to be friends with me, but if I like something, like there are these triplets out there, these three girls who, I don't know where the heck they're from, but they do viral dances constantly. They're basically like TikTok, but on Instagram. And I've liked a couple of their videos. Oh my gosh, Krista, I am suggested every single day since liking their video back in like January. You have to follow these girls. You have to follow what they're doing. You should try it. Oh, why don't you try this music? And I'm like, what? No, I don't want to. No, I thought they were talented and that's the end of it. And I've noticed, like you said, with algorithms that could be very dangerous, that whether it is the person, like maybe that person's profile is shedding light on things like depression, and God bless them. But if you're being suggested to follow them, you might start to become or feel like you're on the same path. Or the more dangerous thing are hashtags. So if you are following, you know, like, so for me, I follow very specific hashtags. But if something were to gear you down a path, and now all of a sudden your social media picks up on, oh, okay, so she likes videos that discuss mental health, so let's trigger more videos that have hashtags that are connected to that. And now all of a sudden you're like in this rabbit hole of, wow, oh, so this must be geared towards me. These must be signs from something bigger than me that I clearly have a problem. Like, that too is very dangerous, like the way that it mind tricks you.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you remember a while back, it might have been over a year now, the Wall Street Journal did a really interesting piece. Like, there's like a video, but basically, you know, the farther you get away from like the big content, right? The, you know, the people with the huge influencers with huge, you know, that are just going to trend because of the size of their audience. But you start giving the apps, especially TikTok, that confirmation with, like you said, with hashtags or likes, or if you watch the same video again and again or something, you start getting deeper, farther and farther away from sort of the influence sphere in terms of what the apps can moderate, right? So it's really, you know, if somebody with a huge following puts something up that's erroneous and you flag it and you send it to them, it's going to be easy for them to figure out what you're talking about and make a determination of whether it was appropriate or not. The farther and farther you get away into the smaller and smaller audiences, it's harder for people to pick that up. And so it's almost like it's sucking you in, like you said, to another realm. And that can be a pretty dark place. I mean, I don't get there, but I also remember pre-social media and pre-smartphones,
yes.
You know, but like these kids today, they don't know that.
Exactly.
So I think, again, it's, you know, one of the things we know about mental health is that parental and positive social support in real life is like one of the key factors in managing issues that you have that arise. So, I mean, that's my best hope for me, is to make sure that as much as my kids are online and I can't watch what they're doing every single second, that we're having the conversations in our house, that we're talking about the fact that so much of the content they're going to find is questionable. Some of it is going to be downright dangerous, and that's okay. Like, you need to know that. They need to be aware. We cannot put our heads in the sand.
Yeah, exactly.
And pretend like it's not.
So this morning we're talking to Krista Carnes, who's our social media consultant, about teens who are going on to TikTok and they're self-diagnosing themselves with mental health issues. And it reminds me a lot of growing up and how many people would go on to WebMD, for example, to diagnose themselves with issues. Krista, during that commercial break, we actually got a call from a doctor who comes on this show pretty often, Dr. Andrew Wang, who is here right now, and he wanted to chime in on the conversation. Doc, how are you? Thanks for calling.
Oh, hey there. Good morning. Just taking advantage of a snow day today and listening in.
Love that.
Just, you know, I'm fascinated by the social media stuff, so I'm really glad that we're addressing it this morning. Just the two things I wanted to mention about it. Number one is social media is not doctor advice. So it can do good things. It can get people interested in their health. But, you know, we know the dangers of the Ozempic craze and how just regular people who shouldn't be taking it all of a sudden are requesting it through social media. And I've seen a lot of unsafe dieting ideas as well. So there was one extreme. There was kind of a TikTok craze or an Instagram craze where people you would sign in and you would ask people just to bully you about your weight so that you would lose weight that way. So just some really unsafe health advice there on social media sometimes. We used to have a saying, when you hear hoofbeats outside your window, normally it's like, oh, hey, that must be a horse. But when you hear too much of the extreme stuff, you think, that must be a zebra. Hey, yeah, that's a zebra outside my house. Mm. It's the same sort of thing with social media, because above all, it's supposed to be entertainment. And the normal stuff isn't entertaining, so people come up with all these, you know, extreme ideas that, you know, maybe this illness is flesh-eating bacteria and not a regular rash, for example. So it's a little extreme. So we don't want to take our medical advice from social media. The other quick thing was that social media can be addictive. Don't use it after 8 o'clock at night. So don't fall into the trap that I do sometimes where I can't sleep. I'm like, oh, hey, let me just, you know, check Reddit or Facebook and I'll put it down in 30 minutes. Inevitably, it's always I'm on it for 2 hours and I end up being more wired than I was. So please don't do social media after 8 o'clock at night.
Dr. Wang, always appreciate getting you
doctor's
to weigh in on
orders,
things.
Yes.
Right? I mean, seriously, Krista, what do you think about everything the doc just said?
No, I think, you know, I can't even imagine how much this must plague medical professionals, all around. And you know, one of the comments to add is that sometimes these people they're there to make money, right? Like they build their followers,
Good point. They get
more, you know, opportunities to work with companies, you know, whether they're legitimate or not, you know, I mean, so there is, you know, ulterior motives for some of this as well. And the psychology of it is we're only beginning to understand it. Am I correct?
I mean, yeah, Dr. Wang, what do you think about, are we, you know, as a society just starting to understand maybe a little bit more the impacts of social media? I mean, from your perspective as a doctor, could you maybe tell us like how much more you've seen an uptick in people who are coming to you and inquiring about things they've seen online versus what it may have been, you know, years ago before social media took over?
Yeah, I think in general, people do understand that advice from a doctor is valuable. So they'll kind of ask me sheepishly, oh, you know, what do you think about Balance of Nature? Or what do you think about this brand for my blood pressure instead of this medicine? So I like the fact that people are at least curious about it. Social media, though, it can be dangerous because I think what I believe we will hopefully establish in the future is corporate ethics. The whole idea that corporations should have a responsibility to their consumers for their health. And right now that's not the case. They have responsibilities to their shareholders and making profits. I think social media takes that to the extreme because, you know, the company is not liable if just a regular person says something that isn't true. And it's going to be, you know, a problem that we're slowly dealing with, but I think ultimately we do need to have more ethics out there in the public.
Dr. Wang, I always appreciate getting your advice on these things and for listening, because sometimes you'll chime in when I never see it coming, and you have such thoughtful things to share to the conversation, so thank you. I appreciate it. And Krista, I think this is such a great topic and something we were talking about before, which was, you know, talking to your teens and really starting that dialogue. I think you've led such a great example with your own children, and we've talked about this a lot on the show. Maybe because we've run out of time, we dive into this a little bit deeper, either in a future segment or if there's a way people could reach out to you beforehand to just even get your advice or ask questions of you of how you start to have these conversations or address like, hey, are you seeing things online? Do you have questions about it? It's sort of like I don't know, back in the day when your parents would approach you and be like, you want to have the birds and the bees talking, you're like, oh, God, no. But you sort of needed to. But now we're like on social media where the conversation, they're like, hey, what are some of the videos that are trending? What are the things that you guys are laughing about or loving? Or do you have questions about anything you've seen, or even being, you know, vulnerable yourself? Like, I find myself to be vulnerable sometimes. I'll go to my husband and be like, hey, I probably sound crazy, but like, what is this referring to? Because I must have missed the boat on this. You know, I think there are ways to kind of bridge that gap so your kids aren't kind of self-diagnosing themselves or turning to other sources that may not be reliable.
I think it's early and often, Melissa. Like, start when they're young, make it part of the natural conversation that these are the things we're going to talk about in our, you know, in our family, and just keep having, you know, it's like a lot of topics that are kind of could be potentially uncomfortable. You got to start often, and you got to go often and early. That's my thought.
Is there a way that people can email you, Krista, if they have questions about this?
Sure. Krista@KristaCarnes.com. Feel free to put that up on, you know, your social media, WICC social media or whatnot.
Yes. But, WICC is reliable, I promise.
Twitter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course. Twitter, of course. And of course, I always love chatting with you, Krista. Thank you for diving into this topic this morning, and enjoy your snow day today.
Thanks. You too.
Thank you. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Krista Carnes here on WICC.
At the beginning of the week, we actually got an update from Pennsylvania U.S. Senator John Fetterman, who says he's doing well and remains in care at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center as he is receiving treatment for clinical depression. According to his communications director, Fetterman is visiting with staff and family every day and staying updated on Senate business and news while he continues to get treatment for his depression, which he says stems from having a stroke in the past. I really wanted to talk about this. I know it was applauded by the president and many other officials, and talking about addressing depression, and even on a national and very public scale, Senator Fetterman saying, listen, I'm struggling. I have to work on this, even though he was just elected in just months ago, and being so public about it. So joining us this morning is Hartford HealthCare's Dr. Andre Newfield, who is the chair of psychiatry at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Good morning, Dr. Newfield. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm glad that you could be here, Dr. Newfield, because I think what is really inspiring about this is that we live in a very polarizing world right now. And when we talk about addressing mental health, one of the things that people are so nervous about is, what is that going to mean for my job? What is it going to mean for the general public? Like, I think about law enforcement, for example, if they were to say they struggle with depression or anxiety, it could mean that they get off the force, because how can we rely on police officers who are, quote, mentally unstable? And the same thing sort of goes for politicians, I would think. Here's a guy who was in a very contentious battle for his seat. And, you know, just months after being elected, says, I'm struggling with something and I need to be working on this while I am doing my work for the country. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I think it's to be applauded. I think that many professions have to think about what it looks like in public when you talk about, as you said, police or doctors or pilots and politicians who are, you know, out in front of the public. So I really, you know, likewise applaud his efforts to be as public about it as possible. I think that there has to be a balance between, you know, private health information and what is being released to the public. But I think it seems to be a good balance so far.
Are there different levels of depression?
Very much so. As we spoke about last time when we were talking about postpartum depression and psychosis, you know, you've got the postpartum blues versus true depression. I think likewise for regular depression, it has, you know, many different gradations. And so you can be sort of down and, you know, a little bit more dysphoric but functional throughout your life. Or there are times when people slip into episodes where it's more severe and, you know, more drastic measures need to be taken. The likelihood is that somebody who's been struggling as long as John Fetterman sounds like he has, you know, has tried a number of treatments so far, and at this point has had an episode where he's needed to go into the hospital. That probably comes along with various symptoms, as I heard he has been having trouble eating and sleeping. For some people, you know, they might even become as severe as becoming suicidal and a danger to themselves. So I'm glad that he's getting the help that he needs.
So we're talking to Dr. Andre Newfield, who's the chair of psychiatry at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Dr. Newfield, what do you think about people getting treatment for depression? First of all, what does that look like? If you were to get treatment for depression like Senator Fetterman is doing, what exactly are you talking about?
So for most people in the country, first of all, they aren't getting treatment that they need. So I highly encourage people to start talking with their general practice doctors about their symptoms or how they've been feeling. And a lot of the times the treatment can be initiated there. And so your doctor can talk to you about either recommending therapy for you to go to, for somebody to talk to, or even start medication themselves at a relatively low dose. These medications nowadays are extremely safe. Side effects can happen, but they're relatively rare. And even if they do happen, they're relatively minor and certainly reversible. So I certainly encourage everybody to start thinking and talking with people that they know, love, and trust, or people that they work with that can get them the help that they start to need. And if it becomes more severe, at least you've started talking about it and have started working on it rather than waiting for a crisis. And sometimes, you know, when either the functioning decreases enough where you can't take care of yourself basically, or, you know, if you're a parent, you can't take care of those that you're responsible for, or if you can't get to your job, or if you start questioning whether life is worth living, you know, then it might be a crisis and either time to go to the hospital and get evaluated for a possible brief hospitalization. Nowadays, hospitalizations average, you know, at most a week. That's the average. And if it's severe, it might need to be a little bit longer. But, you know, there are hotlines, there are hospitals, and there's always 911 for when it's severe enough. But most of the time, it's going to be relatively mild. And if you address it early enough, it will stave off having to be in an emergency situation and possibly having to be hospitalized.
One good thing about today's world is we are becoming more and more open about things like depression, anxiety, and mental health needs. And we know, especially since the pandemic, we became very aware as a nation that mental health needs to be addressed better. It was there well before the pandemic, but it really heightened and we saw that it impacted populations all across the country, all age groups, so on and so forth. And this month, it was a pretty daunting but very uplifting story to learn that Pennsylvania U.S. Senator John Fetterman is now seeking treatment for clinical depression that stems from when he had a stroke. And we're talking about it this morning with Dr. Newfield. And my question with this, Dr. Newfield, is can you accurately or even clinically do your job if you're battling depression without treating it? So in this situation, do you think that U.S. the senator could have continued doing the job without treating it? And also, as a caveat, can he currently do his job, do you think, while he is still battling depression?
So speaking about Senator Fetterman's specific situation, I don't know the details, and it would be, you know, hard for me to characterize it other than to say if he needed to be hospitalized, then he's probably at the moment temporarily not able to do his job. With treatment, he could very well go back to being fully functioning and have absolutely no problem doing it. But again, that's just speaking sort of generally without having the specific information. Many, many people around the country are working with depression and are functional enough to be able to get by, but could benefit from getting treatment and having an improvement in their functionality as well as their quality of life. But there are some people that become dysfunctional enough when they're depressed enough, when they need to get treatment and they wouldn't be able to get by to do their job. And it's completely reversible with treatment most of the time. It's very, very rare that somebody would be, you know, incapacitated for life after depression.
And another question for you. If you have a job that could trigger mental health troubles, like a politician, law enforcement official, healthcare worker, teacher, heck, let's throw news reporting in there because I'd love to know. Should a person be seeking treatment for an evaluation, or should they be looking for signs of struggling or a shift in their mental health because of their work, because of what they specifically do, and maybe how and even just getting criticism from the public?
I think everybody should be looking for signs of depression in their lives and, you know, looking at how they sleep, how they eat, how they are able to go about their routines. Most people who end up in these high-pressure jobs have had a long road of preparation along the way so that they can see how they're responding to stress. I think part of the weeding out process is to determine how people can handle the stressors when they're in school or when they're in training for these professions. And so most of the time, it's not going to be coming out of nowhere. I think once you realize that you might be prone to these issues, trying to address it as soon as possible so that you can work out, you know, your coping mechanisms that work for you or get the treatment that you need so that by the time you've worked so hard and achieved getting to that goal of being in the profession you so choose and are probably wonderful at, you can function at your highest level.
Dr. Newfield, my last question, what are signs of depression?
So it'll most likely start with, you know, a generalized feeling of being down, perhaps, you know, including tearfulness or derogatory thoughts about yourself, that questioning your self-worth in terms of I'm not good enough or things along those lines. There is crossover with personality issues there, so it's not always depression if that's what you're thinking about. It starts to get more serious when it affects your sleep or your appetite, again, your ability to function and get out of bed on a pretty routine basis. We all have those days where it's tough, but if it starts becoming a pattern, then you want to be a little bit more cautious and seek out help sooner. And then the higher levels are where you're really not functioning well at all in terms of your basic functions of life, in terms of eating or sleeping, caring for yourself or others, showering, things along those lines, cleaning up and having basic hygiene and nutrition. And then really, you know, starting to question life or taking actions or steps to end your life by, you know, some means of self-inflicted injury.
Dr. Andre Newfield, again, with Hartford HealthCare's St. Vincent's Medical Center, the chair of psychiatry. I thank you so much for having these kinds of discussions on WICC, and I know we'll talk again really soon. Thank you.
I applaud you for taking up the issues as well, Melissa. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Newfield, and please be safe, you and your colleagues heading into work this morning, and we'll talk again really soon. That, again, is Dr. Andre Newfield, the chair of psychiatry at Hartford HealthCare's St. Vincent's Medical Center. Fran Mako of AAA is here. Talk about a news release you had sent out earlier this month. Beware of fobs being robbed. First of all, for anyone who's not familiar, what is a fob?
Okay, the fob is a little gadget on the new cars you hold in your hand. Your car doesn't use a key to start. You have what is called keyless entry, keyless start. You press the button on the dash. The car stops. When you park, you press the button again. It turns off. But you need this wireless transmitter in your hand or in your purse or in your pocket to be near the car in order to start. And the latest heist, I mean, just when you thought it was safe to park in your driveway, we hear all the stories about the catalytic converter thefts. The latest thing is thieves, they're not stealing the actual fob. What they're doing is they're hijacking the fob's radio signal. And a lot of folks just aren't aware of the risks associated with that. The thieves use technology. They use special equipment, and I'm not sure where they get it or they could develop it because they're hackers. What they do is they steal the radio signal that's coming from your fob because it's a low-power radio signal to start the car, and they're watching you. So you turn your car off, you go into your house, you go into the shopping plaza, wherever it is, they're able to steal that signal, and they're able to get into your car even though you locked it. And a lot of these folks, they don't necessarily, their intent is not necessarily to steal the car, because the car, if the car gets started, you can drive it a certain distance, and then when you're away from the radio signal, it's going to die. But they go through your car to steal valuables. So if you have your laptop or groceries or Christmas presents or stuff inside your car, you know, they're watching, they're looking, they're spending a lot of time looking through cars to see what they can steal. And unfortunately, there's no, for lack of another word, evidence that there was a break-in, because they don't have to break a window anymore. They don't have to hotwire a car. They just simply use this equipment, steal the signal with the equipment, open the door, rummage through your car, go through the next thing, go to the next car. I mean, it's amazing the creativity these bad guys use. I mean,
yeah, it's crazy.
If we use this stuff for good, we would probably have world peace. I
say that all the time, Prem. That's like my number one phrase in life. If scammers could only use their smarts for good, my gosh, where would we be as a nation? And I do want to remind folks, so you're saying many new cars and trucks don't require keys to unlock their doors or start engines, so they rely on these electronic fobs. So I know, you know, people in my family or even just friends of mine who, like, they don't use a key to turn in the – I do. I still have an old school, like, you know, key in the ignition to get it started. But you're talking about just putting the device in your car and then, like, putting your foot on the brake and pressing that button in the car. Okay. Yes. I just want to make sure I understand it, because you have those Apple fob things that people have been scared of. I can't remember what those are called. The Apple – you know what I'm talking about? The AirPods or something like that? Your keys your wallet. You know, this is different. This is what comes with the car.
Yeah, it's like a keyless remote transmitter.
Yep, okay.
You know, and when I do my presentations to older drivers, you know, I say, and I talk about the new technology, I says, these fobs are great. You will never, ever lock your keys in your cars again.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you leave the fob in the car, my car beeps if I leave my fob in the car.
Yeah, so I've had family members who,
that.
The car won't lock, for example, if you leave the fob in there, things like that. But there are cars that'll just let you leave them in there. I have noticed that, you know, that you can leave it. I always think, though, that's very strange. Honestly, like I never understood. And again, I'm not trying to judge anybody, but like I would never leave my keys in the car, even if I was in the garage of my own home. I just think that's bizarre. Like I have fears, maybe of even dating back to when I was a kid, of keys getting locked in the car, because I've done that before. I've never left keys in the car.
A lot of people do it.
I know. I don't get that, though.
If you leave the fob in the car and walk away, anybody could get into that car and drive off with it.
Well, and I think, too, and we've talked about this with retired Lieutenant Jim Perez on the show when we do Crime on the Mind every week. You know, people, I think, believe that there's almost like this invisible fence or something or gate that keeps you off your driveway. Driveways are actually semi-private. They are not considered private property because you have mail carriers who come up without permission, UPS driver. So I think a lot of times, even if it was private property, people are bold. I mean, they will come up to your driveway and they will steal your catalytic converter. They will go into your, you know, like they'll break window. They don't care. So I just think there's like this mentality of, oh, you'll never come up my driveway. But if I had to park on the street, I certainly will take my keys, but not in my driveway. It's very bizarre. I don't know.
They are. I mean, in my neighborhood, I'm on this neighborhood Facebook page, and I cannot tell you how many reports every night somebody is reporting that somebody broke into their car, somebody stole their catalytic converter. You know, and these folks are fast.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like it takes a long time to steal a catalytic converter, because they know what they're doing.
They do. Yeah, you're right.
But it's the same thing with the fobs. And if you have valuables, you know, you can minimize or protect yourself by protecting that fob. Now, do I do this? Heck no. You know, to lessen the chances of thieves robbing you, you know, that signal, it's been said you can store your key fob at home in a metal container. Do I do that? I don't do that. I mean, some people wrap it in tin foil. Or you can buy these, I can't remember what it stands for. I think it's an RIFD pouch.
Are you talking about like when they're in the house, or you mean when they're in the car?
Well, if your fob is in the house,
I got
you should put it in a metal container. Now,
interesting.
Do I do that?
No.
No.
Most people probably don't. But, I mean, that's it. Especially if you are somebody, though, that maybe you've seen an uptick in car thefts or car break-ins, things like that. If you are more on the nervous side, that is a good point that you could, you know, something as simple as just wrapping it in tinfoil, not a bad idea. Or if you do have, I mean, gosh, people have metal containers like that are pen and pencil holders on their
right.
office desks. So maybe you just, you know, you put it in there at the end of your day. And that's also where you'll never lose your keys, because now you have a designated spot to protect them and to make sure you know where they are.
True.
So it could be two birds with one stone.
You know, and just store your valuables in the trunk or glove box.
Or bring them inside.
Yeah.
I always have been made fun of because I bring my purse in and out every single day when I go home.
Too.
And it's mostly my own family. My husband and my son will be like, Mommy, where do you, like, what are you doing? And it's like, well, I just never know. I just never know. So I always take it in and out. I don't know. But Fran, really good tips. I was not even aware that this was going on. So I thank you so much for the inside scoop. And hopefully if people have fobs out there, they're now aware and they'll better protect themselves.
And a lot of this is anecdotal. There's no statistics because
right.
it's so new.
Mm-hmm.
It was just something that I read about in other states, and it's like, I wonder if it's going on here. And unfortunately, I hate doing this. I hate discussing stuff like this on the radio, because now I always wonder, am I giving the bad guys a bad idea to do something?
No,
like
trust
this?
Me, Fran. They're 700 steps ahead of us. They just are. Because I've had this conversation with Kristen Johnson with the Better Business Bureau before, and sometimes she will see trends in other states, and then she will put releases out. And when she first started the job, she's like, I feel like I am just laying out a silver platter. And I'm like, no, I really think most scammers, this is their job. I mean, think about it. This is what they do for a living. They certainly are not doing full-time jobs, and then they're like, meh, you know, I have an hour off tonight. Let me see if I could scam people. This is what they do. So I promise you, they probably have heard of this. They probably are already doing it. We just haven't heard reports about it. Or people haven't caught on to, why were they able to get in my car but didn't break a window? I must have left it unlocked. Like, it probably just hasn't been reported. Yeah. So I don't think you've cracked a case here, but I do think you've told a lot of people. I mean, I just think a lot of people probably, I didn't know about it. So I appreciate that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't worry, Fran. You're doing way more good than telling, you know, if anything, you're like, hey, scammers, we're on to you. So.
Okay. Very good.
Yes. Super Fran to the rescue. And Fran, I always appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Until next time.
Until
Take
next
care.
Time. Enjoy the storm. All right. Fran Mako of AAA here on WICC.